The deadline has expired, and Illinois has moved into its 11th month without a budget. Hours before Senate Democrats soundly rejected the budget plan House Democrats had passed last week, Governor Rauner had already condemned their actions.
Today, we end the spring session of the General Assembly in stunning failure. Stunning failure by the supermajority Democrats who control our legislature.
Today, we talk to people who are grappling with the consequences of that inaction.
It's just been so hard and so sad for so many people in our organization and across the state.
And we've been asking you all morning, how does not having a budget make you feel? So far, we've heard disgusted, afraid, powerless. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet to 21st Show. Later, the Tony Award and Pulitzer Prize-winning duo Behind Dinner with Friends are teaming up again for a new play, Long Lost. We'll speak with them about their Urbana production. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Welcome to the 21st. Well, it's June 1st. Lawmakers worked all day and night, and in the end had pretty much nothing to show for it. The regular legislative session has come and gone, and we're still without a state budget. Just before midnight, Senate Democrats resoundingly rejected a plan House Democrats had passed last week. It was a plan Governor Rauner had said he wouldn't sign anyways because it had a $7 billion revenue shortfall. Today, Governor Rauner is crisscrossing the state to promote his short-term fix to the mess, a stopgap budget that would keep K through 12 schools and what he says key government services open. Yesterday, while with one breath he pleaded with Democrats to pass his plan, with the next, he also slammed their lack of agreement.
The Democrats have spent our state into the toilet for 30 years. We're like a banana republic. We can't manage our money, and employers don't have any confidence in us. They won't come here if we can't get our act together and balance our budgets. I will always veto unbalanced budgets. I will not sign one, and I will not sign a tax increase unless we have pro-growth, pro-investment reforms, and we have property tax protection for our homeowners and our small business owners.
At that late afternoon news conference yesterday, the Republican governor hammered Democrats, especially House Speaker Michael Madigan. Democrats pointed the finger right back at Rauner, but the united front we often see among Democrats in Springfield broke down in the final hours. The Democrat-controlled Senate overwhelmingly rejected a budget proposal that had passed the House last week, led by Speaker Madigan, and the last-minute funding plan for grade schools and high schools passed the Senate, only to be shot down in the House. We're 11 months into the current fiscal year without a budget. There's still another month before the next budget year, but now lawmakers need a much larger supermajority to get a deal done. In a few minutes, we're going to be finding out more about what happened last night, what it all means, and what comes next with two political reporters. All morning, we've been asking you on social media to fill in the blank and tell us how not having a budget makes you feel. Maria says, "No budget in Illinois makes me feel embarrassed and powerless. Lawmakers have one job, personal interest. Interests are being put above people's needs." You can keep tweeting those comments to us. 21st Show is our handle. You can give us a call to share them as well. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. There's a lot at stake in this debate, especially for the groups that are directly affected by the budget standoff. Mark Stutrud is CEO of Lutheran Social Services of Illinois and joins us now by phone. The statewide group last year served 73,000 people in the state. 80% of those people had an annual income of less than $15,000 a year. Lutheran Social Services of Illinois runs programs across the state, including everything from foster care to alcohol and drug treatment programs to affordable senior housing. Mark, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking time to talk with us. Mark? I wanted to start by asking you the same question we've been posing to people on social media all morning. You know, we had just had one comment. Aaron says not having a state budget makes him feel insubordinate about paying state taxes. Anne says it makes her feel hopeless and powerless and angry and uncertain. As the CEO of Lutheran Social Services of Illinois, how are you feeling this morning of June 1st without having a state budget?
It is very disappointing and very frustrating to have those who are most at risk, you know, in our state to be affected by the impasse created in differences of opinions as to what needs to happen in order to release money to pay for service.
Mark, the governor's stopgap plans call for funding for some human services programs, and I wanted to play a little bit of Governor Rauner talking about the plan yesterday.
We've also sponsored a bill today, this morning, to make sure that essential government services, our university system, our healthcare system, our correction system, our government operations that our citizens depend on can continue to function through January, which is the time frame that President Cullerton indicated would be the time frame that they'd be willing to negotiate a truly balanced budget and a broad-based compromise. So we are calling on the General Assembly, don't wait. Don't hold our schools hostage. Don't hold our government operations hostage. Don't hold the people of Illinois hostage. Pass these two bills now to bring stability to our state while we continue to negotiate in good faith on reforms through the working groups, and we get through this crisis. Hopefully we can come to a broad compromise before the general elections.
That's Governor Rauner yesterday. Mark, do you know how Lutheran Social Services of Illinois, how much your organization, if you all would get funding if this stopgap measure passed?
Well, we just received an email from Linda Lingle, the chief operating officer for the governor, and she was asking for support on those bills. And we are paid in really a singular way, and that's either if the monies are court-ordered or they fall under some type of court consent decree. And otherwise, we're not paid. And those general revenue funds that are not able to be appropriated because they don't fall under any court order or consent decree are those that are owed to us in services like home care and services in mental health and some in substance abuse. And that totals for us about $4.2 million that the state owes us. Now, that's backlogged payments that have not been paid since July 1 of last year. And then, of course, we have, and we see some delay at times with other payments that are even under the court order or consent decree as well.
Where do you guys stand with your budget now then? Because I know there's the backlog, there's what the state, what the money you are getting, the money you aren't getting. What's the bottom line for your budget right now?
Well, I mean, we have to operate on a cash basis like any other organization that receives the revenue for service. We're a partner with government, and government has not been able to be prompt and has been backlogged in their payments to us because of the budget impasse and the economic condition of the state overall. And we are not able to go further unless we continue to not serve clients in the areas of which we are not paid. So we have to stop the expense against the non-payment. And in doing that, you know, we are able to hold our own and to continue to move forward with those services that revenues are received.
Mark, I know that you all in January announced layoffs of around 750 people. There were some programs that were cut. What programs have you, since then, can you give us a sense of what programs have been cut over the past year and kind of what your backup plan is now that the funding hasn't come through?
Well, the programs that were cut were in home care services to senior adults, and that included over 2,000 senior adults that were served in their homes. And then the other programs that were cut had to do with some mental health and substance abuse residential programs, primarily. And that's the $4.2 million that were owed by the state. And we continue, though, you know, with the largest foster care and adoption provider in the state. We continue in homes for persons with disabilities. We continue in affordable housing and in many, many behavioral health and substance abuse programs in the Chicago area as well.
Where do you go from here?
Well, we wait to hear from the governor and the legislature on the budget in the sense of is this stopgap measure going to come to be in through January to give us funding? What's going to happen? You know, we're waiting to some degree for the other shoe to drop. We don't know exactly what the budget will entail, what will be the detail in the sense of what can the state pay for in the future. We're not sure about that. We don't know if there'll be further cuts. They've been talking about cuts to Medicaid as an example. And then we're just waiting to know as well the changes that are going to happen within state structure of how services are delivered. I think most people don't understand that the budget impasse is going on, and we're all experiencing it. But at the same time, government has been planning for a number of transformations and changes, and we're not certain as to what that will entail either.
So lots of uncertainty for you going forward. What do you want people to know about the situation, maybe people who are not your service providers or clients that you all serve?
Well, I think overall, from a taxpayer perspective, everyone should understand this is not good for the state. The longer that we wait in the sense of enacting revenues that could in part support service, the larger our debt grows. And that this state is probably looking at significant restructuring. The other is that taxpayers should be wanting to know about the cash position of the state itself. We're not in a good position, and yet it's not necessarily transparent. How do we get transparency in the sense of what monies are available and how are we going to move ahead in the future? And to know that none of this gets better without finding that resolution, making hard decisions, and finding the revenues to support the service.
That's Mark Stutrud. He's the CEO of Lutheran Social Services of Illinois. Mark, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All morning, we've been asking you how a lack of a budget makes you feel. You're tweeting to us at 21st Show. You're giving us a call as well. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to Matthew in Nokomis. Hey, Matthew.
Oh, how are you?
Go ahead. How does not having a budget make you feel?
It makes me feel that Governor Rauner is not doing his job because the state of Illinois should declare bankruptcy. There's no logical, rational, or mathematical solution other than bankruptcy. The government employees especially have set up a program giving themselves wages and unbelievable pensions, which we cannot mathematically meet.
Thanks for sharing that, Matthew. I appreciate it. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Teresa Harper says on Twitter, it makes me worried about the future of Illinois students. Other folks are saying Democrats and Republicans are using the poor and sick as pawns to further their own power. There's nothing good here for Illinois. Joining us now to talk more about how this is affecting his particular group of folks is Anders Lindahl. He's the public affairs. He's director for AFSCME Local 31. They represent 38,000 state workers throughout Illinois. Anders, just wanted to give you a chance to respond to caller Matthew there saying that state workers are who's holding the state hostage right now.
Oh, well, I think, sadly, that's misinformation that's coming out of the governor's office and some of the right-wing anti-government groups that the governor has funded. The reality is that not only the public service workers and state government that AFSCME represents, the folks who protect our kids and keep our communities safe, respond to emergencies, not only are they going to work every day serving their communities amidst all of this uncertainty, but so are all of the other thousands of public service workers in AFSCME who work in our state universities, who work in private sector not-for-profits that are funded by the state and dependent on a responsible budget to provide care for people with disabilities, and mental health services, and so much more, as well as thousands of AFSCME members work for local governments.
Well, Andrews, I think maybe this comes from Governor Rauner has repeatedly said that state workers are the highest paid workers in the country. And I know that's something that you've said and AFSCME folks have said you find frustrating, these kind of statements. Why is that?
Well, I think it's more than frustrating. It's just categorically untrue. The University of Illinois has done a serious academic study of public and private sector compensation in Illinois and nationwide and has found that there is actually a wage penalty in public service in Illinois. If you look at similar type of workers with similar type of education, you're paid 13.5% less in a similar job in the public sector in Illinois than if you were in the private sector. State workers are paid about number 10 out of the 50 states in the state of Illinois, but all wages in Illinois for all workers, public and private, are ninth nationally. So the compensation for public service workers in state government is right in line with all workers. in Illinois. And we're a top 10 state for compensation. But that's because our state has made choices that we want to be a high wage state with a vibrant economy and to pay working people wages that can sustain their families. We don't want to join a race to the bottom with Mississippi and Texas. That's the direction that Bruce Rauner wants to take our state. But, that race to the bottom is harmful and wrong.
Anders, last night, a bill that would take labor negotiations, the contract negotiations you've been trying to have with Governor Rauner, it would take it out of his hands and into arbitration. That again failed in the House. So it's twice that veto override failed. So it seems that the union right now has no choice but to work with Governor Rauner. So given everything you've said, and we just got about a minute left, where do you want to go from here?
Well, we have said all along that we want to find a negotiated solution at the bargaining table, a contract settlement that's fair to all. The governor walked away from the table on January 8th and has refused to negotiate. It's actually a mirror image of his hostage-taking tactics on the state budget and his refusal to simply sign a budget without predicating it on his middle-class weakening personal agenda. Governor Edgar pointed out yesterday, that's what's holding up the budget. That's where the responsibility lies on Governor Rauner's shoulders. And his refusal to negotiate a fair contract for public service workers and state government, the same. So we simply wanted to extend to all state employees the same option of a fair arbitration process that's already used for state troopers and prison workers, as well as public safety workers at the city and county level, like police and fire.
Thanks for that, Anders. That's Anders Lindahl. He directs public affairs for Ask Me Local 31. We're asking you how you feel about a budget. Patrick says the challenge is too great for a fill-in-the-blank. Governor Rauner should make the best deal possible, and Democrats need to accept some reform. Keep tweeting. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering knowledge in its disciplines by recruiting and retaining library faculty, researchers, and thought leaders with deep subject matter knowledge and expert librarianship. The University Library at Illinois.
Nyla Boodoo, welcome back to the 21st. We're talking about what happens next in the state budget standoff. Any resolution will involve a compromise of some sort, but that's something that seemed pretty far off during last night's meeting of the state legislature. We've been asking you how this lack of a budget, if you're keeping count, it's the beginning of the 11th month, makes you feel. Matt says it makes me feel like the reason everyone's leaving Illinois isn't because of a poor business climate, but because government is incompetent and ineffective. You can keep tweeting to the 21st show. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to Sarah in Villa Grove. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the 21st. What's your comment?
Hi. I think that the voters in Illinois should vote every incumbent in the legislature out of office and recall the governor and start fresh with unbiased, unconnected, intelligent human beings.
Thanks for that comment, Sarah. Everyone else is welcome to call with how they're feeling. This is your opportunity to express how you're feeling now. We're 11 months into this situation. That's what we've been doing all this hour, talking to social service providers, to labor groups. Our phone number again, 1-800-222-9455. We wanted to give you a little analysis on the situation, too. Chris Kergard covers politics for the Peoria Journal Star. Dave McKinney reports on politics and public finance for Reuters. We were all up last night watching this all play out and interacting on Twitter. They're joining us now from Peoria and Springfield. Hey, guys, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
Hey, thanks for having us.
The headlines this morning focused on Rauner's phrase, stunning failure. And I think everyone's heard that sound about it, but I think we can actually play the whole bit of what he said. So let's hear what he said.
And the spring session of the General Assembly in stunning failure. Stunning failure by the supermajority Democrats who control our legislature. The Democrats in the General Assembly have failed to pass a balanced budget. They have failed to pass reforms to protect our property taxpayers. They have failed to pass reforms on our pension system. They have failed to pass reforms to grow our economy and create more high-paying jobs. They have failed to pass reforms on our political system through term limits. Stunning failure again.
That's Governor Rauner yesterday. Dave, let's start with you. Do you think that captures the mood and the tensions in Springfield right now?
More than. I mean, I think he nailed it on the head. And what was so interesting was the timing of that announcement. It was about 5 o'clock, you know, on the end of session there. And usually, you know, in the past when I've seen these end of session days, you know, you've got the people, the main players, the governors, the legislative leaders, wanting to kind of put their spin on things after the end of the night when we know for sure what's going to happen. But he had a sense, apparently, that things were just going to explode. I mean, that was the stunning thing about yesterday, that the level of Democratic dysfunction in the state house. You know, when everybody, you know, he talks about the supermajority Democrats as if there's some monolithic, you know, all powerful entity there. And what we saw yesterday was anything but that. They could not get their act together. They were the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
Chris, I wanted to ask you about that, because last week we saw Speaker of the House Michael Madigan push through a budget bill with support from Democrats in the chamber. And then last night we saw Democrats in the Senate revolting. There was going to be a vote, then there wasn't a vote. And then finally the Senate defeated that budget by a large margin. What do you think the message was there from Senate Democrats, Chris?
I think the message from them was that they want a larger seat at the table or to be consulted at all. This is hardly the first year that the House and the Speaker, as leader over there, has tried to take the lead and walk not just his own chamber but the other chamber into a budget that he is pushing. And I think it was a sign to him that he needs to be a little more inclusive in working with members of his own majority party in both chambers.
Dave, what were you hearing from both the GOP about Democrats and Senate Democrats last night?
I'm sorry, Neil, I'll repeat your
question. Yeah, I was asking, what's your read on what lawmakers are sort of the morning after everything yesterday evening in the Senate with Democrats? What's your read on the situation and what are folks talking about?
Well, I think moving forward, people are pretty resigned to the fact that what we've been seeing happening for the last 11 months is going to last at least until November, if not beyond that. You know, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago when there was the big labor rally in Springfield. We had one of Madigan's top lieutenants, you know, just postulating about the possibility of not having a budget for the entire 4 years that Rauner is governor. And, you know, I don't know that that's an unrealistic scenario given what we saw. I mean, I think, you know, what was stunning to me yesterday about the way the Democrats handled the whole situation was just, it was misstep after misstep. I mean, you know, in the morning we were all greeted with a memo from the governor's budget office laying out the framework of, you know, another one of these stopgap appropriations bills, and it would have taken care of some of the bills in the current fiscal year, you know, including human services and including, some of these critical funding areas that have been left out, universities, and then including a little bit of money for fiscal 17 as well, not only for universities and human services, but also for public schools to open on time in August and September. The Democrats, you know, no sooner had they gotten that presented to them on in the morning yesterday, they came out. They said, "Look, we're not going to do this today," and you know they. They, I think, both Culleton and Madigan believed that they had this plan figured out where, you know, it was either going to be the Madigan passed budget that was in the Senate that got passed and that, you know, sort of presented this dilemma to Rauner. What do you do with this? You know, if it lands on your desk, it's $7 billion out of balance. Do you just, you know, hack the thing to pieces? Do you scale back this massive increase for schools, you know, school funding as they had in there? It was like $700 million, which, you know, he proposed only spending about $55 million more. And they liked that scenario. They also liked a separate standalone bill, because that was one of the things that the governor was asking for: give me a standalone bill. Well, the standalone bill that wound up being structured was one like in the House bill that was so far, you know, I think Christine Rodonio called it fantasy land. I mean, it was, again, $760 million more than you know, what we had in this year's budget. Neither one could get the votes needed in that Senate to pass. And it was just, you know, the caucus that got 39 members in the Senate Democratic caucus. And neither plan, you know, got more than about 20 votes when they were polling themselves before going out onto the floor. So,
Dave,
you know, I think for Culleton, it's a weakness, you know.
You've covered the legislature for quite some time. I don't know how you would even characterize last night in the context of the history of sessions we've seen even over the past decade.
Well, I mean, it's depressing in a way to watch, you know, because usually, I mean, this is affecting lots and lots and lots of people, and you know, the thing that. You know, the thing that you really have to sit back and wonder about are, you know, I heard this being brought up sometime, a couple of times on I think it was on the House floor, one of the members, you know, talk about the prospect of people dying as a result of this. And you know, that sounds like dramatic language. How could that be possible? People barely know that state government exists in a lot of sectors of Illinois. But yet, you know, one of my ex-colleagues at the Sun-Times, he had a column a few days ago that said that, you know, the suicide hotlines that the state funds that aren't getting any funding and that aren't open now. You know, what is it like if you're one of those people who is reaching out and trying to call one of those things and you know, call back in 4 days? That is, you know, when I think about yesterday, that's kind of what I think about. It's like this is this level of this chicken, you know, this game of chicken that we're playing is affecting lots of people in very bad ways.
That's Dave McKinney. He's the politics and public finance reporter for Reuters. We're also speaking with Chris Kergard. He covers politics for the Peoria Journal-Star. And you, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. We're talking to you about how you're feeling about yesterday. Folks have been tweeting. Matthew Johnson says he's heartbroken and outraged for the most vulnerable and embarrassed to be a resident of this state. Let's go to Eric in Bloomington. Hey, Eric, welcome to the 21st. How are you feeling?
Hi.
What needs to happen?
Good. I am, I grew up here in Bloomington, but I've lived in Chicago and Colorado, and I'm a small business owner, but I am in total support of the governor. We need reform. We need new ideas. We need action. The Madigan entourage has been in charge of our state for at least 20, 30 years, and they consistently do nothing but cater to unions and public employees. And Mr. Rauner is a breath of fresh air, and I'm sorry, but we can't kick the can down the street any longer. Many people in Bloomington and other cities in our state are taking up residency in Florida, and if people can move, they are moving. And Mr. Madigan, again, needs to be pointed at. This guy is totally concerned about himself. And that is it.
So, Eric, how would you suggest Governor Rauner? How would you like to see the situation resolved?
Thank you, Mr. Madigan. I'd like a new Speaker of the House. I would, in an ideal world, his district would vote him out of office. And but the Democratic Party has been in charge of our state legislature for many, many years, and so I would like new leadership. But with the current leadership that is in there right now, what solutions do they have? Their solution is nothing. They just want to raise taxes.
Thanks for that comment, Eric. Yeah, no, thanks for that. I appreciate it. That's Eric in Bloomington. Our number is 1-800-222-9455. Chris, Dave, I wonder if you can weigh in and follow up on Eric there, because Dave, I think the likelihood of Speaker Madigan being voted out in his district is pretty minimal. And actually yesterday, I wonder, Dave, if you could address something I think folks didn't notice was yesterday was also the filing deadline for elections for November, right? So as we're looking to the fall, what are we looking at in terms of leadership and seats in the Illinois House and Senate?
Well, I think the Democrats are expecting a big year in the fall because they believe that you know, Hillary Clinton, with all of her problems, is still going to win Illinois by a rather large margin over Donald Trump. And if that happens, they think there could be coattail effects and you know, result in perhaps getting truly functioning supermajorities for them in the House and Senate. That's what they're striving for. You know, the filing deadline yesterday the way that that what that was all about was you know, if there wasn't a primary in these legislative districts, the party that didn't have, you know, a representation in the general election had the opportunity to put a candidate on the ballot up until 5 o'clock yesterday. So on a day when, you know, we were down to the wire, that deadline had everybody on edge at the Capitol because, you know, it just made these votes or potential votes even more all or nothing. And, you know, I think, you know, I don't think that there were truly any surprises out of the filing yesterday, at least from what I could tell. You know, I saw some Democrats putting candidates up in some of the suburban areas that Republicans typically hold. And, you know, there were some Senate races that, you know, became competitive. But, you know, that in the end wasn't, you know, that wasn't the headline out of yesterday as much as it was Democratic dysfunction. Because, I mean, seriously, one of the thoughts that I have about all of this is that the, you know, just if you consider the day before, the Democrats were riding high. I mean, they had overridden Governor Rauner on this bill that would have
for Chicago fire allowed, and police,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm. And that was a huge victory for Democrats. And Madigan comes out of a budget meeting along with Cullerton, and I mean, he was gloating over that. You know, he was cracking jokes about how, you know, he was taught never to raise embarrassing things with somebody because it was rude and, you know, Cullerton was laughing and everything. So they had peeled off two House Republicans, you know, and the Democrats thought, finally, we have got a crack here in this Republican front. Well, you know, fast forward 24 hours, and the cracks are just as prevalent on the Democratic side as they may be on the Republican side.
Chris, where do we go from here?
Hey, that's an awfully good question.
Because, yeah, as we think about this, you know, I'm thinking about Eric saying, and we've heard people saying, look, we want to vote these people out. But the reality is even if that were to happen before November, we're looking at another 5 months without a budget, a year and a half of a state functioning without a budget.
Exactly. And the fact remains that the vast number of legislative races around the state are going to be uncontested races, and the incumbents are going to win. Recall of the governor, which was brought up by an earlier caller, is something that is designed to be extraordinarily difficult to accomplish and requires buy-in from both parties. So just kicking all the incumbents out does not seem to be a realistic answer. I think that we will start to see at least some progress or further progress among some of these working groups with the heat off, without a immediate deadline looming in everybody's face of May 31st, I think that we'll start to see some quiet progress from those working groups. And certainly, President Cullerton indicated yesterday that he had hope that there would be some movement within the next week or so on at least a short-term budget. Now, at this stage, I don't know how much of that is going to bear out, given anything that the governor might say during his two-day fly around to the state, urging what he wants to see come out of a short-term budget. But I think you've also got very restive troops on both sides who now, for a second summer, have to go home and explain, even if they don't have a candidate running against them in the fall, legislators who have to go home and explain to their constituents and folks who are in some of these areas that have been missing state government payments, that have been without any assistance from state government, why it is that they couldn't get the job done for a second session running. And I think that's going to cause greater pressure on them, along with some of the other
so much. And that's
including Catholic Charities today, sending signals that they might have to relook at what they're funding.
Yeah, and as we say that, we've got to wrap up here. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank Chris Kjærgaard and Dave, Chris Kjærgaard from the Peoria Journal Star, Dave McKinney from Reuters, and ask you, Dave, really quickly, we've even heard as we've been asking people how they're feeling. Everybody's running the gamut of I support Governor Rauner to I'm embarrassed and I think we need to leave this state. How does this situation get resolved, Dave?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that you know, after yesterday, Governor Rauner has to be feeling empowered. And you know, whether the deal that he put on the table for the stopgap, you know, spending plan, if that's still on the table, we don't know. I mean, he wouldn't commit to that yesterday during his
Yeah, so we'll see where it's at. We've got to leave it at that. Thanks so much. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Pulitzer and Tony Award-winning duo Behind Dinner with Friends have teamed up for another production. Long Lust is part of the Sullivan Project. It begins next Wednesday in Urbana at the Krannert Center. It's a play about two estranged brothers and their reunion later on in life. In studio with me, Donald Margulies is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright behind the production. Daniel Sullivan is also with us as well, the Tony Award-winning director. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So maybe we should talk about the play first. This plot focuses on, as I've been told, the rather sordid history of two brothers who have a long overdue reunion. I like that it says, everything I've gotten about it says it has adult themes.
Yes.
How did this story come about?
Ooh, where do plays come from is sort of the larger question. Well, in my experience of writing plays, which I've been doing now since I was 20, plays usually come from a place of disquiet, where I find that I'm thinking about something a great deal, whether it's a relationship or the newspaper or wherever these things come from, sometimes dreams. This play, I think, emanated from a schism that occurred in my life that I was trying to make sense of. And that's very often what I do through writing, is trying to dramatize sort of unspoken things to kind of make them concrete and tangible and maybe even understandable.
Well, and in this case, the estrangement comes apart because of the death of their parents. Is that correct?
Right. But I don't want to divulge too much about the particulars.
Why such a dramatic choice, I guess?
Well, because, you know, as a dramatist, I'm always looking for high stakes. And the higher the stakes, there's more opportunity for conflict. There's just more at stake. So the fact that there is this thing that occurred in the past that affected the relationship between these brothers who are now middle-aged, I think just gave me fodder for some meaty material to contend with.
Daniel, I wonder if you can explain a little bit about the Sullivan Project and how that works for plays that are happening at... This is the second time you all have done this at the Krannert Center in Urbana.
Yes, and... Normally, we'd be doing it actually during the academic year. Things didn't work out that way this year, so we've sort of tucked it into this slot. But the idea is to bring professional actors and the best playwrights we could find into the university.
Such high praise.
Let them interact with the school. So... it is designed by university designers and stage managed by the stage management staff here. So it's to use. I'm a Swanlon professor. I have a Swanlon chair here, and the definition is that it's to bring. Arts professionals and science professionals into the university. And so I've just sort of extended that into actually beginning productions here.
That's Daniel Sullivan. He's the director. Donald Margulies is with us as well, the playwright. Donald, you came here with Long Lost and you had a couple scenes because this was originally commissioned in Tennessee, right? So what's the process like when you come here? The past couple weeks you guys have been in rehearsals. When people come next week, what will they see?
They will see a fully staged, fully memorized text that's been, performed by, equity actors and, under Dan's direction for several weeks. The play began as a commission from the Nashville Repertory Theater a year ago when I was a fellow at their Ingram New Works Festival. And part of my singing for my supper in Nashville was, in addition to being the playwright in residence who would mentor the writers who had works in this festival, I also was required to present a new work. I didn't have a new work that I felt that I could really show to anybody. So I began writing a new play. And by the time I needed to present it in Nashville, I had three scenes, which was unusual for me to be presenting something in a public setting that it was so unfinished. When I had those scenes and Dan invited me to come here as part of the Sullivan Project, I said, well, I've got these three scenes. Take a look at it. And Dan read it and said, finish the play. So I finished the play on April 30th. I finished the play. And I sent the text to Dan because he would send me these little emails saying, we really have to get this to the actors.
Where's the play?
So, because okay. We had cast it. Miraculously, these actors agreed to be in it before they saw a complete
text.
Well,
and you have a great cast, and I want to get to the who the cast is in a minute, but this is a little bit related because, Donald, I know you've written for a variety of different media, and I read that sometimes you subsidize some of your playwright work by writing for Hollywood. Is there more pressure when there's an adaptation like you did with The End of Tour? Mm-hmm. Than this, which is an original work?
You know, I think that plays that come from me, that come from my marrow and my psyche and my neuroticism, I feel more personal to me. When I do an adaptation, which is something I thoroughly enjoy, it's much more of a sort of an intellectual pursuit. You know, it's problem solving. It's figuring out a puzzle. And I really do enjoy that very much. But the plays tend to be much more closer to the bone.
And you all are working, as we mentioned, I wanted to mention some of the actors who were in this because the stars of this, Kelly Acoyne, from his Pastor Tim and the Americans,
Tim.
Which is on now, so I think
yes.
Everybody will know that
yes.
one, and David Alford, who plays, he's the manager in Nashville.
He plays Connie Britton's manager.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is it hard, and Dan, I wanted to ask you this as well, both you, Dan and Donald, is it hard when you're seeing actors switch between television, and that's a very common thing nowadays, everyone's switching between film
yeah.
and television and theater. As a director, is that more of a challenge for you as for them to be in that space?
Not really. You're talking about this specific project.
Mm-hmm.
These actors are all trained in the theater. So let's say that they make a living in television, but their first love is the theater. So and we were very lucky to get all four of these people. They're quite wonderful. And one of the reasons I think that we get them is that it's a relatively short rehearsal period and we only play it for a week, so it's a month commitment altogether.
Donald, would you say that's true of you as well, that maybe you make your living in Hollywood or in television, but your first love is the theater?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I define myself as a playwright who subsidizes his career in the theater by writing movies that, for the most part, don't get made.
Dan, by the way, I want to say congratulations on your recent Shakespeare Society Award.
Oh,
and
you.
Ask you, how much of the family drama that we're seeing here is maybe akin to family drama that we often see played out in different Shakespeare?
The stakes of this play are Shakespearean in size, I think. You know, one of the things that I love about the play is also people see this huge event that's happened in the play from very different perspectives. So it's no one is really in agreement about what that represents in the lives of these people.
And I know the setting for this is a pretty intimate space because this is the studio theater mm-hmm. at Cranart. How are you all using productions or multimedia to create different spaces and effects throughout the performance?
Well, we're doing what's called a transverse staging, which means the audience sits on either side of the action. So it's that means that we can use props, furniture in a very simple way, so we don't have to do a lot of walls. But we do use projections to jump us from place to place. We're trying to do it as simply as possible, so it's not all about production, it's about the play.
As we think about that, Donald, the production, the actors, it's a one-month commitment. You've got a chance to, I don't know if workshop is the right word, but sort of really work out this piece here. Is it? Do you find that there is a different thing to do this in, say, a Nashville or Urbana than in a smaller theater in New York or Chicago?
Well, you know, I think one of the attractive things about being in the relative safety of Champaign-Urbana is that you don't have to worry about the New York Times here, and because the New York Times will find you wherever you are.
Well, now, I'm worried because they may hear this interview and find you.
But no, I'm only being slightly flip, which is that, you know, it's so rare that a playwright gets to develop something in the safety of a work environment like this. You know, particularly, you know, now that I have a reputation in the theater, it attracts more curiosity. And in the blogosphere, which is notoriously snarky, you can sometimes be victimized or shamed rather early in the process while you're still trying to figure something out. So, no, I'm very pleased that we're getting tremendous support here from everybody associated with the project.
That must be really tough for younger playwrights. You're established, you know, you're very, obviously, you've had a career, award-winning career. People know your work. I wonder for someone starting out now in the environment of critique is so different now than it was, say, even 10 or 15 years ago. It must be really hard for both of you, I wonder, to do your work in that environment.
Well, it is. But, you know, I teach playwriting as well. I teach undergraduates at Yale. And what I've discovered through my students who move on into the real world, there are many, many more options, I think, today for young writers than there were 30 years ago when I was starting out. There are many more plucky groups where people are putting on their own readings. It's a very vibrant, if slightly off the radar, scene. So I do think that writers find hospitable environments. I just think it's innate in who a playwright is. You need to find homes. And I think they do still exist.
Well, and Dan, I imagine you would say that you think Central Illinois is one of those hospitable environments. I wonder if you think there's more of a trend of being able to do these things in smaller places outside of the big theater centers of the country.
Yes, I think so. I mean, certainly it takes some money to do that. But I think it is moving out into the regions. It's not so localized as it used to be. It used to be Chicago, New York, L.A., maybe San Francisco, but I think that you know, just the fact that this really started in Nashville is an example of how it's moving out into the country.
What have you guys learned together from working together over the years? I'm thinking from Dinner with Friends till now. How are you guys? How is that relationship?
I've learned that Dan is always right.
This sounds like a long, successful marriage.
We can stop it right there.
We've been working together for 18 years.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable.
Yeah.
And we like each other.
And trust each other, I think.
What do you want people, or for folks who were planning to see this next week, how would you prepare them? What should they expect to see? Because we haven't talked very much about the plot, and I know you want to keep it mysterious, but what can you tell us? Well, now you're both gesturing at each other.
Well, I don't want to, it's Donald's play, so.
Yeah, I tend to be one of those writers who gets very uncomfortable describing his own work. Because it always sounds reductive, and even when you're talking about a Shakespearean play, if you talk about it sort of in plot terms, it sounds like, you know, daytime television. so that the issues in the play, it's a family play. You know, to call it a drama maybe suggests that it's kind of dark and lugubrious, but there's a lot of humor in the play that comes out of the characters, which is the kind of writing that I like to do. There's relief from darker themes, as there are in life. There's relief. So it's not even though it's being characterized as a drama, you can attest to this better than I can describe it, but it's like being in somebody's living room
during an awkward Thanksgiving dinner.
Well, in this case, it's Christmas.
Okay, all right. That's Donald Margulies, the playwright. Daniel Sullivan, the director. Long Lost will play for 7 performances beginning next Wednesday at the Krannert Center's Studio Theater in Urbana. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That does it for us today on the 21st. Tomorrow, we'll be talking with Illinois residents who've lost family members to depression and suicide and hear why they're speaking out about the truth about how their loved one dies and died in hopes of helping other people. Thanks for tuning in today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is on our website. That's at 21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman, Austin Keating, and Travis Stancil. Technical direction comes from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks to everyone who tweeted and called today. You can keep the conversation going. Go to our Facebook page. Search for the 21st. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.